honestly don't think I'm funny. Just me. Not talking about those guys.
You've honestly never said one thing I have ever found at all funny, bro.
What do you know about funny? Chicks aren't funny. Dudes are funny. Hangover 2 rules. Bridesmaids? Drools.
You gotta
be first.
Okay, and are you ready for the show?
Yay, we're ready, Lucy. Please start.
And so I started.
This is Pete Holmes. I'm a comedian. I'm with my boy, Will. You're listening to the Homemade Broadcast, because you're smart.
Personnel, this is CVTS. Base vehicle pre-count operations will start on my mark at 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It is the Homemade Broadcast, HMB Radio, on RadioSt.Pete.com, Sunday, 6:15 p.m., and Mondays. Don't forget, if you miss out, the replay, 10:15 p.m., RadioSt.Pete.com, and on podcasts, Mondays, HMBRadio.com. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcast. We are in the process of switching over this RSS feed to another provider, which I am technologically illiterate, so it's hard for me. Okay, so back off. So hopefully it's working now. I hope. I've been getting a lot of help from the people at Blog Talk. So Jay has been awesome. Amy's been awesome. They designed me this really cool show card that I got new, so you'll notice that on iTunes, and I saw that today, so I'm assuming that everything's A-okay. I'm hoping so. So make sure you check out hmbradio.com to get this here program, the Homemade Broadcast, hosted by myself, Will Kuntz. I think I forgot to introduce myself, as I always do. We got the HMB sides, extra content heard only on hmbradio.com. We have James Bailey's My Mom's Favorite Podcast, the Dallas Cowboys Podcast, and more coming this year, hopefully. I talked to a friend of mine who has a fantastic idea for a podcast involving old wrestlers. So hopefully that works out, and that will be on the air shortly. HMBRadio.com, Facebook.com/HMBRadio. On Twitter, you can follow the program, home_made_man. Instagram, same thing. So make sure you do that. And this podcast is brought to you by Sly Bar. New food arrangements. They put in their new kitchen. Check out the Creative Loafing this week. They have a nice little article about their new food selections based on Joe Robertson's favorite show, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Every entree sandwich is named after an aspect of that program. So make sure you check out the kitchen there, 2061 Central Avenue. The stand-up comedy open mic is the second and fourth Tuesday of the month. Check out hmbradio.com/events for info on that. And today on the show, we have a returning guest, Mr. I. Lee Coleman. He is a writer in the area, and he wrote The Confessions of a Bogeyman that was featured on ESPN's Outside the Lines last year, I believe he was on, and now he's got a new book called A Breath of Fresh Air. So we're going to bring in I. Lee, talk about that. I. Lee Coleman, welcome back, my friend.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
So I had spoken to you. We conversate on Twitter from time to time, and you were talking about this book, and it was finally starting to come to fruition, and the last chapter was giving you hell.
Yeah. the last chapter, you know, when you're going through the process of writing, and, you know, this is a project that's been in the making for some time now, as you know, and I struggled with getting the ending done, as right. You and I have been talking, and so it sat for like 6 months, and, you know, I wrote some things and rewrote some things, then I had to go back and change some things, and it just started to become a nightmare. And I really, really wanted to, you know, bring it to some type of ending, you know, but nothing was coming out. And so, you know, one night I just kind of said, oh, God, please, please help me, you know, give me some type of ending so I could finish this project. And lo and behold, the next night I actually jumped up at like 3 a.m. And penned out this ending, which I thought was actually pretty great. And then got it done. Got it done. So I was happy.
Is it harder to, I know the ending is probably the worst part, but is it harder to begin or end? I would imagine just sitting down, knowing that you have this, I don't know, I mean, how many pages is your book?
I believe it's 200 and maybe 237, something like
that's
that.
That's a lot of pages. So I'm assuming, like, you're knowing that I have to write at least, you know, 150, 200 pages for this book. That in itself would be a feat.
Yeah, you know, but when I sit down to write, I'm not thinking about page count, really. You know, I'm kind of going off this premise of something that I've either saw or something in my past. And in this case, you know, the Fresh Air Fund, the book is based upon experiences with the Fresh Air Fund, which is a huge organization in New York City, where I'm from, where basically they allow the inner city kids, underprivileged kids, get a chance to join this program, and they connect with the host family, and they get to do things that they wouldn't normally get to do in their home surroundings. So the book is based upon my experiences within that organization, but it's not an autobiography. So basically what I did was I took some experiences and wrote a story around it, and it came out quite interesting, so I'm pretty proud of it.
Yeah. So this Fresh Air Fund, when did they get started, and when did you have your experience with them?
The program itself has been in existence for, let's see, I mean, I started the program when I was 5 years old.
Oh, wow.
So, and it's been going on, you know, some time before then. I'm not exactly sure when it exactly started, but, you know, when I joined the program, my mom, you know, she was a young mom, and so she put me in this program at five. And I go 5 hours away to, you know, I'm thinking about it now. It's like giving me chills because I don't know if I could do that with my kid, you know. But you send a five-year-old 5 hours away to folks you've never met before, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of daunting, you know.
Sure.
But, yeah, I got in. She actually, so I got in, and I go to this family, and I went for the first 7 years. To the same, well, I've been going to the same family my whole time, so I never, you know, went anywhere else.
Right.
But we went through the Fresh Air Fund for the first 7 years, I want to say, and then they wind up moving from Corning, New York to Dublin, Ohio, and so it became a hassle for me to leave New York City on the bus, drive 5 hours to Corning, and then turn around. You know, them come from Dublin, pick me up, turn around, and drive 7 hours to Dublin. So
sure.
They basically just said, look, we'll fly you. And so, you know, that was my first experience on a plane and all of that stuff. So, but
how old were you then?
Let's see. So seven, five. I had to be right around 13, maybe, when I took my first flight. And so, yeah, so a lot of first experiences. You know, having to do with that program, but it was amazing. It's still amazing. You know, just looking at what it's doing and kind of, you know, reconnecting with them now. And, you know, I got the book in their hands right now, so never know what, you know, what's going to transpire out of that. But I'm proud of it.
Do you still stay in contact with the family that you visited? And was it like a summer thing? Or?
Yeah, the program actually goes for... From what I understand of the program, you're supposed to do 2 weeks, but mine, you know, we kind of fell in love with each other, you know, and they like who I was, the kid that I was, and so I would stay the whole summer, and then you know, once we started to bypass the program, it was just basically, you know, them sending me a plane ticket and saying, hey, come for the summer, we'll do these things, and we'll fly back home. So, it was just a tremendous experience.
Is the family that you you're adopted, I guess, second family, is it more taking, so you said they come from the inner city, so I'm assuming it's mostly black kids that go to white families?
Yeah, it was more, you know, black and Latino kids, from that urban inner city, New York City area, the five boroughs. When you look at it, those kids are used to brick buildings, yeah. Right? Not really any grass. The only animals you see are probably rats, roaches, and pigeons, you know, squirrels. So you get to go into this new environment, and, you know, it's totally different than what you're used to. So there was an adjustment period there. But as a kid, you know, you don't see color. You don't see color. All you see is fun.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it was for me. Fun in the daytime, a little challenging at night because of just, you know, as we were talking, in the city, you hear the sirens and all of the noise, you know,
right.
That you sleep through, and you get used to that. But up there, it's quiet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's really serene, but I'm not used to serene vibe,
right,
you know,
right,
during those years. So
sure.
It was challenging at night. Right, so I had to be rocked to sleep a little bit, you know, but it was an adjustment period for me, but it turned out to be the best thing ever.
How did you get involved originally with your mom taking you to the program?
In my neighborhood, there was a basically a sign up for this program. I'm not really sure how she. Where I come from, it was huge. Pretty much everybody kind of knew each other in the neighborhood. So my mom was, you know, fairly into things in the neighborhood. And so all of these programs that were available, I don't want to say all of these programs, it wasn't a whole bunch of programs,
yeah,
but,
right.
The programs that were available, you know, she took advantage of it. But then the funny thing about that, the joke running behind that is, okay, so you're a young mom. Are you really looking at this as, hey, you know what, I want to give my kids something to... something different, or, you know what, I want to get this kid out of here for the summertime, you know, so I can have some free time to myself. So that's the running joke. But whatever the case was, it turned out to make all the difference in my life. So I thank her for that.
Yeah, it definitely seems like it seems like today, I don't know what's going on. Things are not good. Things are not good.
Yeah.
I am aware of that. I'm wondering, though, if it's blown out of proportion as far as race relations go. I feel like the media makes it worse than it really is.
Yeah.
And we only see what they show us, because there's a lot of good that goes on too that nobody really cares about.
Yeah.
But I know that there's issues.
Yeah.
Certainly. What's you're a black fellow. What's been your experience?
Well, you know, it's I think that, you know, especially with kids today, and, you know, with the internet and all of that stuff, the world is smaller to them. And a lot of their things, they're able to share likes, whereas, you know, if I lived in the inner city and someone, let's say down here in Florida, I would never be able to reach somebody like that, you know. So I don't know what your likes would be. I don't know what, you know, how we would have common ground, right, unless we were on a sports team or something like that.
Right.
But now with these kids being able to share the internet and share their likes, their dislikes, there's a lot of commonality that's being shared. And these kids are allowed to connect, whereas that wasn't the case, you know, when I was growing up. I think race stuff, you know, I really don't try to get into it too much, but I think it's, you know, it's a learned thing. And the kids of today are getting past that for the most part. And I think it's the elders who kind of keep it going more than it need to be. And as far as the media is concerned, they want to sell stuff. So I don't think, you know, the kumbaya stuff sells. It's the controversy that sells, really, right?
So. Certainly. Yeah, I think that's very true. But there's a lot of things, like, I know on the USC campus, there's calls for black-only zones on the campus, which blows my mind. I can't believe that those kids' grandparents aren't grabbing them by the ears and saying, hey, you're screwing up everything
yeah.
that we worked so hard for.
Yeah. I don't know.
So I think it's almost like the kids are really, they think that everything's so terrible. They don't understand that it was really bad not too long ago. And this is all petty stuff, I feel like.
Yeah, yeah. You know, a lot of stuff is piggybacked on things that shouldn't be. And it's unfortunate, but, you know, things that are, that start out as good-natured things turn out to be something totally, you know, what it does need to be, should I say.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
I think there's this thing where people do not, people are really nice now. I think they're at an all-time level of nicest. We don't want to offend anybody. We don't want to hurt anybody. So we definitely give this, we give a lot. And then when you give, you kind of, now there's a lot of issues. Oh, well, I can get this. Now I need a trigger warning because there's talk of you can't read Huck Finn anymore or something like that. You can't, because there's words that are not appropriate.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I think sometimes we can go over the line, you know, with how much is too much. And... You know, I think in all of that, the humanism is lost, you know, because one of the sidebars of technology is you lose your people skills, you know. And I think that the people skills are something that needs to be sharpened up on, you know.
That's an interesting point. I'm glad you brought that up because that is very true. We are more connected as a global world, a unity. We're on this, you know, spaceship, and we can all instantly talk to each other on Twitter, but we don't talk to each other anymore.
Yeah.
You have the anonymity. I can't say that word. Anonymity?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
So you can say really terrible things to someone that you don't even know.
Yeah.
And it's terrible, man. You'd never say to people's faces.
Well, you know, just my sidebar in technology. So I'm having this conversation with this guy, and it just shows how something can be taken. You know, you could write something, and someone can take it totally different. So I was asking him for help with something, and he had told me, "Hey, listen, if you need me, you know, just reach out to me. You know, and I'll be there for you, right?" And so, you know, something had come up where I did need him, so I text him, and I asked him for help. And he writes back with why. He just puts a why on there, right? And I'm like, well, you told me if I, you know, so I'm saying to myself, what do you mean why? Like, you told me if I needed you, you'd be there for me. So here I am, I'm starting to get a little flustered because I'm like, man, you just, you know, you told me a lie or whatever the case may be, right? So instead of just picking up the phone and calling him, it festers. So I'm mad at him. Because he writes why. But it never dawned on me that when I finally got up with him, you know, I asked him, I said, well, you know, you told me if you needed me. He said, yeah, the why means yes.
Right, right.
Who knows that?
Yeah.
How would I know that the letter Y means yes?
Mm-hmm.
But to him, that was his language. That was his language. But in that moment, I asked him a question. He was writing, yes, I'll help you. But he wrote why. The why was for yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I took it as why? Why should I help you?
Why are you asking me? Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So, and that's, you know, that's where things could go really, really left. And that's where I, you know, I kind of try to make sure when things start to get a little vague, pick up the phone.
Yep.
And let's be human.
That's the way to do it. Yeah. And also, you can't tell tone either. Yeah. Tone's really important in communication.
Yeah.
And with written communication, you don't get that. And especially if you don't. If you misplace a comma or put one where it doesn't need to be, it can change the whole.
Oh, yeah.
And with texting, you know, like you said, it's just one word. My dad texts, and he types like a 14-year-old girl. It's humiliating whenever I get now he's using emojis. I'm like, you got to stop this. It's making me uncomfortable. I just don't like it. I barely use them, and you're almost 60 years old. You need to stop this. So, yeah, it's definitely challenging to communicate with text.
Yeah.
So how did, and even when you're writing your book, have you had any challenges with trying to, you have something in your head, but it's hard to put it down on paper?
Yeah, because it can get challenging at times because, you know, in the book, the book is about these two guys that they go through these trials and tribulations and within their neighborhood, outside their neighborhood, into the world, kind of, you know, going from childhood to adulthood and back and forth, you know. So there's dialogue. And then, you know, these obstacles that they come in contact, whether it be physical or in the form of a person, other characters. You have to, when you're writing, well, when I'm writing, I have to put myself in a situation and actually have that conversation with the other person who's not there.
Right.
So I have to become a character, talk to myself, and then turn and answer myself, which is kind of odd. But you find yourself having all of these weird different conversations. So tone becomes an issue. How are you receiving it becomes an issue. So it's really challenging. It's fun, but it's challenging.
Yeah, I'd imagine it's kind of like math, you know, like you got to put a comma somewhere that, you know, it's hard to tell. Ilee Coleman has joined me on the Homemade broadcast this week. He has a new book that's available now on ileecoleman.com, A Breath of Fresh Air. So this book is not an autobiography, but I'm sure there's a lot of you in the book.
Yeah, there's things in the book that has truth to it. And it's just, you know, again, the story is surrounded by these truths. And, it's really the project itself was really an undressing in a way, because I started to tap into emotions, tap into, experiences and things like that. And, it was hard because you have to kind of, I don't want to say hard. No, hard is not the word I'm looking for. It was interesting because these experiences, how I remember, because again, you're talking about when I started from five until the age of like 17. So all of those years of experiencing all these different things, I had to remember some things and give them to some characters, you know, which it made it actually kind of fun because it took me back to a time when my innocence was in there, and the way I saw things and the way I interacted, you know, and it was cool because, you know, becoming an adult and then speaking to those folks, they got just as much from me as I got from them.
Oh,
and
certainly.
I never even thought about that.
That way,
I didn't think about that. Didn't think about that because, you know, we touched on race a little bit, but, you know, you're going to an all Caucasian area, per se, and they probably never dealt with, you know, a black kid before.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, my experience with them, had I been a certain type of way, could have tainted their outlook on, you know,
sure.
a whole. So it became huge. And they told me that later, you know, and then I realized, and I was like, wow, that's really, really an interesting dynamic to that whole Fresh Air Fund thing. So the Fresh Air Fund program is just so amazing because of those things. You know, just taking on that project and putting it out there, it was awesome, actually.
Is that, where can people find the Fresh Air Fund?
The Fresh Air Fund is actually based out of New York City. It's their website, I believe, is www.freshair.org. And I actually have the book out on Amazon.com as well in electronic format as well as paperback. And the cool thing I found out is that Mariah Carey is one of their spokespeople.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Was she involved with the program when she was younger? Or?
That I don't know. I haven't dove in that much to kind of find out. But I know, I think for the past, I want to say 5 years she's been involved. Might be longer than that. Just was looking at their board of directors and looking at their affiliations. And I know they're heavily into that tri-state area. They're ingrained in that tri-state area. And also Tiki Barber is on there.
Longtime New York Jet or New York Giant.
Yeah. So there's some named folks that's actually affiliated with that, and I think they are they receive a lot of donations. They just had some big gala recently, and you know, I just was on a website, and it was amazing. I'll tell you the story how this came about a little bit, because so I just told you about my experiences, you know, a little bit, and how it kind of gave me a certain outlook on life. And so one day, this happened like maybe 3 years ago, the website that was on their Facebook, and someone had left some comments that weren't the greatest. And I was like, you know what, if someone reads this without a rebuttal, you know, they may feel a certain way. So I felt compelled to write something based upon my experiences. So I jotted a few sentences down, just kind of saying, hey, okay, you know, that's probably their experience, but, you know, my experience was totally different. And so after I shared, I want to say maybe 20 minutes later, I get a phone call, and it was from the PR department at the Fresh Air Fund, so like their marketing director, and his name was Jake Grinstead. And he reached out, and he goes, hey, I understand you're writing a book. And I said, well, yeah, and I fabricated a little bit, because he started asking me questions about, you know, well, when do you think you're going to be done with it? And, you know, if it reads like anything like your comments, we may want to help you promote it. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, really? So I started getting a little shaky. And so he said, well, when do you think you'll be finished with it? And I said, October. And I just threw that out there. I hadn't even started yet. And so I was like, oh, my God. So, you know, here I am. You know, I get off the phone with this guy, and now I'm compelled to write. And lo and behold, nothing comes out. Nothing. I mean, literally, mental shutdown. Nothing. I couldn't remember anything. And so it sat. And a year goes by, and a year and a half goes by, and I'm like, oh, my God. And nothing's coming out, because I'm forcing myself to write.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I just sat back and said, okay, you know, stop thinking about the promo, stop thinking about all these other different things, you know, write from your heart, tell a story. And it wasn't until I did that, that, you know, things started to materialize. Then I get through one chapter, then I'll get through the next chapter. And then lo and behold, things started, you know, the dam starts to break, and out comes the story. You know, but some time had elapsed, and when I was reaching back out, I had, you know, you're talking about 2 years now, and I struggled with an ending, like I said, and, you know, so when I finally get it together, I'm like, okay, I gotta reach out to this guy. Oh no, what's the guy's name? So, you know, 2 years had gone by, I misplaced all of the information, so I call up to the Fresh Air Fund, and they actually had a new executive director. I reached out to her. She actually reached out back to me, and kind of pointed me in the direction of the marketing person, and whose name is Hannah Beck. And so I send this email. We go back and forth an email. I couldn't remember the guy's name. And then I told her the scenario, the situation of the book. And so she asked for a copy of it. So I send her a copy of it. She acknowledged that she got it, so it's in her hands. She's reading it now. But then all of a sudden, I forgot how I did this, but wind up reconnecting with Jake Grinstead. And Jake, Hannah goes, oh, well, Jake used to be my boss. So, yeah, it's crazy. So right now she has the book, and, you know, I don't know what's going to come of it. You know, there was a few people that read the book and kind of said, hey, it reads like a movie. And so that was really, really, I felt great about that, because I was like, okay, if you can place yourself inside this story and see what's going on and view it and read it like a movie, then maybe I can make
maybe
a movie.
Be a movie, right? Yeah.
Exactly. So,
yeah, totally.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting, man. The only thing with those things is I know that studios will buy rights to books and then never do anything with them.
Yeah.
I don't know what the deal with that is, but... I'll keep my fingers crossed for you, man. Yeah, that would be really cool.
Yeah, I wish I could have my own funding to be able to you know, take the story and do it as I see it, you know. I have friends that sit behind the camera, but it takes dough, and I'm looking for the dough. I would need the funding to do that, and I'm really don't know. I don't know how that process works, but I can see, you know, how things play out. So I could be some type of consultant for, you know, the written script or whatever like that. So that would be kind of cool. I think that would be an interesting
definitely
to do.
This book is different than The Bogeyman, which is available on ileecoleman.com as well, because that was more of just your experiences with golf. This one is a real story. Did you have to go in and, like, make, like, you know, how they build a building, you got to put up the foundation first and things like that? Or did you do that, have a plan, or did you kind of just go and just free write?
Yeah, no, you know what? I hear a lot of writers, you know, they say that they start with a plan, and this is how they want the story to be written. And I really don't go through, in a way I go through that process, but not really a written agenda or schedule that I follow. I just basically kind of pen this story on how I remember, because a lot of my stuff comes from true life experience. And so I'll pen it and then just let my free thoughts go. And I'll just write until I exhaust that memory or exhaust that feeling or whatever it is. And then once I do that, then I'll go back and then say, okay, well, no, this needs to go here. And then I'll start playing with things and moving it around a little bit. But for the most part, it's just a free written tell a story as if I'm sitting here with you telling a story, because I want to capture emotion in it, right? So I want you, when you read it, to not read it as, you know, someone's reading a story. I'm sitting here with my best friend and he's telling me this story, and it's so engaging that I can almost smell it and taste it and feel it, you know what I mean, and see it. So when someone tells me that, yeah, man, dude, I can see, I felt as if I was there, and then I start smiling because I was like, yeah, I got what I was
captured
looking for.
Your goal. Yeah, definitely. Ilee Coleman is joining me on the Homemade Broadcast this week. We got a few more minutes, Ilee. So I want to know, are you playing any golf?
Yeah, well, a little bit. Yeah,
Not as much.
I want to. You know, but I haven't been able to get out there as much, and I need help with my swing because I'm screwing up my wrists and my ankles and all the other things that doing an incorrect swing goes along. So if anyone's out there that can help me with my swing, please reach out.
Well, at least you're not Charles Barkley. One of my favorite things is just to watch the GIF or the GIF or whatever you call it of Charles Barkley's golf swing.
Oh, that's
it. It is hilarious.
Amazing. That's all you can say is amazing. I actually talk about that in the Bogeyman as well, too. That is a funny little piece because, you know, I don't care how bad I am, I'm not Charles Barkley bad, but
It's amazing, too, because he's he's on TV. He's probably got some money. Take some golf lessons, dude. What are you doing?
But I heard he was a good golfer prior to. Somewhere along the line, he developed that bad hitch in his swing.
He stops mid-swing and then slows down.
Yeah, you know, I liken it to, I was laughing with a friend of mine, and it said it looks as if Charles has a battery in his back and some kid is playing with a remote control and just kind of the battery dies in the middle of the swing. You know, so it looks crazy, but you know, Charles is an interesting character, and he'll make money, and people love him, and he's revered. You know, he gets to say whatever he wants. You know, and people just love him. You know,
yeah, he's a lovable character. He certainly is.
Yeah, definitely.
How did you deal with? Because you got a family, you know, you have a job, and then you're writing this book. I mean, that is. A lot of time that you have to devote, and writing a book. I mean, you got to. How many hours did you spend in a night? You know, but
like I said, well, the book was something that it took a while. And like the first book, you know, I wrote in a couple of days because it started out as a joke, and you know, was writing and captured how I started playing golf and all the funny things that happened. And that stuff was just really on the top of my mind. So I was laughing all the way through that one.
Mm-hmm.
This one here started to touch emotion, started to bring back memory, either things that I've experienced or someone else's experienced or that I witnessed. And so it was kind of it took a little time because it took time because I couldn't write. It took time because I did write, and it took time to eliminate stuff and go back and rewrite because there were some things that I put out there that I said, whoa. I don't know if I want to share that. You know, right. So you go through that gate as well, too. You know, how much of yourself do you put out there? How much truth do you tell? And then how much truth do you get into without it being biographical? So you have to be – so I was a little careful with that. And I didn't want it to get into – because these are still characters, right? And, you know, I didn't want anybody to say, well, yeah, this is his book that he wrote, and this character is him, and this really happened to him. And, you know, so I didn't want it to – someone to think that it was autobiographical.
Right.
I wanted them to be able to pick the story up and say, okay, these are the characters from the book. This is what goes on. These are the conversations they have. These are the true emotions that they have. And, you know, I can relate to this character or I can relate to this character. Or I know a friend that's like, you know, so that's what I wanted to happen. So it took a little time, but it also allowed me to go back through doors that I had shut for years. And it was fun.
Yeah, it gives you the opportunity to kind of reminisce and go over things and probably stuff that you even forgot about that you that you remembered.
Yeah, you know? So true. And, you know, I had a friend of mine who you know, the interesting thing about this book was another aspect to it was, so a friend of mine from college, we had reconnected after some years and we played college basketball together, and I went to visit him. And so I'm sitting there with his wife and myself, and we're just shooting it. And somehow we got on to this is what happened in the past, right? So I started talking about, you know, my time in the Fresh Air Fund, and they were like, "What?" So he didn't say it right away, but later on I found out he was like, "Dude, you blew me away." And I was like, "Really?" So he said, "You know, I had never heard of the program." So he calls me later, and he goes, after you left my house, we were so intrigued with your stories and how that program had made such an enormous, you know, had a great effect on your life that we looked into it. And I'm glad to say that we became host families because of the stories that you told and that how it affected you. We wanted to be able to be a catalyst to affect someone else's life like that. And it took me back because I was like, wow, right? So you think about that, it's like, so... because my mother put me in a program when I was 5, and it made all the difference in my life. And so, you know, I go through and meet these people during my life, and I'm able to, you know, kind of interact with all of these different kinds of folks. And then I share that with someone who then takes it and becomes a host family to do the same thing that my host family did and give somebody else a chance.
Right.
Right? So that's
like full circle. Yeah, that comes back around.
Yeah, that's powerful. That's powerful. So I say that to say this because I go on and so as I was coming down towards the end of the book, and I put the finishing touches on the book, 2 days later, I get a call from my friend and he says, "I have this incredible need to write you this letter." And I was like, okay, you know, and so he pens this letter, and it was amazing. He started just kind of going over the conversation we had, what happened, how it affected him, and what's transpired. And it was so moving that I put it as the preface of the book. So when you open this, when you open the book, you're going to see this letter that is truly written by Mr. Paul Carew. And he's sharing from his heart. And so what that does is it gives you the basis of this story now that you're about to read. So it fits so perfectly. I was like, wow. So, you know, when I sent the book to Hannah Beck at the Fresh Air Fund, I was like, wow, I'm delivering a full-fledged package to you. You know what I'm saying? So if someone reads that and they're like, well, I don't know if I want to become a host family or, you know, why should I become a host family? You can read that book and say, wow, yeah. I know now the enormous effect that, you know, by me volunteering to do this or become a part of your program, how I'm giving back and affecting all of these other different things that you may not even think about.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. It's available on ileecoleman.com. The book is called A Breath of Fresh Air. You can also get the Bogeyman about Ilee's experiences with golfing. That was featured on Outside the Lines on ESPN. When was that, last year?
I think last year, 2 years ago. I can't even remember. My brain is gone. the books are also available on Amazon.com and Kindle, and it's out there in electronic format as well.
Oh, so now that you got these two under your belt, I would imagine another one's bubbling to the surface now.
Yeah, you know what? As I dive in and start to unleash the creative side, as I started to embrace it, it's like, wow, all of these things that I didn't know I like, you know, I'm wanting to challenge myself to do now. So I got this, I started making these characters, and I think I want to write a script now. Yeah, so it's pretty cool because I started thinking about all these different things, and they're like drop-dead funny. And then there's some, you know, everything that I do is based around some type of humor. I these characters are just so funny. And I think I got the basis of a script. And I think I want to start putting that together and just kind of see what happens. So.
Like, are you limiting yourself to, like, you said you don't do that with your writing, with books, but like a movie or a TV show, or what are you thinking?
I don't know. I'm looking at, just different, because everything is still so new to me. So, I forgot what they call the initial write-up, where it's not the script, it's actually what you pitch. I guess the pitch.
Right.
The pitch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you put that together on this is what it's about and where it takes place and stuff like that. And, you know, here's some characters. And so I kind of got a couple of those kind of put together. Just pitching it to some. You just never know what comes out of it, you know.
That's true, man. You just got to do it. That's what I've learned in this life is – if you don't do it, it's not going to get done.
That's so true. So true. I'd rather someone else tell me no, than me saying what could have been.
Yeah.
I'm shutting it down before it starts.
So. It's hard though, because when you do something that you're putting yourself out there, you open yourself up to criticism. And I think most people tell themselves no, just because they can't deal with people being critical of them. But man, it's very rewarding if you can finally get to the point of sharing yourself. That's what you're here for.
Oh, yeah. It's such a freeing, because I've always been like that. I've always been so critical of myself that I wouldn't share too much because I didn't want anybody else to criticize me, criticize what I've been through, because I took offense to that and I was shut down. So I stayed closed up for a lot of years. And I think it actually hindered a lot that I could have got done, people that I could have met, maybe some relationships that I could have, that could have standed the test of time just due to the way that I could have handled things or, you know, at least shared myself or shared a little bit more of myself. Because, you know, when someone reads something that I've done or looks at something that I've done and then you get these reviews like, oh, my God, you really wrote that? Or, you know, I relate to these characters, or, wow, that's great. And I'm looking at that. I'm like, really, you really like my stuff? Like, wow, thank you. but it's you know, and then it gets to the point of, okay, yeah, so I am able to do something. I am worth something.
You are certainly worth it, my friend. Ilee, thank you very much for coming on. Can you give out your social media quickly?
Yeah, you can catch me on Twitter. I'm at Ilee Coleman. That's ILEECOLEMAN. Facebook is just Ilee Coleman out there. My website, www.ileecoleman.com.
Very good. Ilee, thank you very much. You can find me on Facebook, facebook.com/HMB Radio. HMBRadio.com, Twitter, home_made_man. Talk to you all next week. Have a good one. Bye.